first. You can't build up amino acids out of hydrogen atoms. A good deal of complexifying has to take place first. The same situation. Abstract thought, varied social interaction, intricate cultural adjustments, aesthetic and ethical perception, all of it has to reach a certain level before the connections can be made, before the potentiality can be touched at all. Perhaps we Athenians haven't attained that level. You're far beyond it. But luck is involved, as in the creation of amino acids. Or to take analogies on the cultural plane, only analogies, but they illuminate the scientific method, for instance, the use of concrete experimental techniques in science. There are peoples of the Ecumen who possess a high culture, a complex society, philosophies, arts, ethics, a high style, and a great achievement in all those fields, and yet they have never learned to weigh a stone accurately. They can learn how, of course. Only for 500,000 years they never did. There are peoples who have no higher mathematics at all, nothing beyond the simplest applied arithmetic. Every one of them is capable of understanding the calculus, but not one of them does, or ever has. As a matter of fact, my own people, the Terrans, were ignorant until about 3,000 years ago of the uses of zero. That made Estravin blink. As for Gethin, what I'm curious about is whether the rest of us may find ourselves to have the capacity for foretelling. Whether this, too, is a part of the evolution of the mind, if you'll teach us the techniques. You think it a useful accomplishment? Accurate prophecy? Well, of course. You might have come to believe that it's a useless one in order to practice it. Your Handara fascinates me, Harth. But now and then I wonder if it isn't simply paradox developed into a way of life. We tried mind speech again. I had never before sent repeatedly to a total non-receiver. The experience was disagreeable. I began to feel like an atheist praying. Presently Estravan yawned and said, "I am deaf. Deaf as a rock. We'd better sleep." I assented. He turned out the light, murmuring his brief praise of darkness. We burrowed down into our bags, and within a minute or two he was sliding into sleep as a swimmer slides into dark water. I felt his sleep as if it were my own. The emphatic bond was there, and once more I bespoke him sleepily by his name, Theram. He sat bolt upright, for his voice rang out above me in the blackness, loud, "Arek, is that you?" "No, Kenley, I am bespeaking you." His breath caught. Silence. He fumbled with the Chabe stove, turned up the light, stared at me with his dark eyes full of fear. "I dreamed," he said. "I thought I was at home."
"You heard me mind speak.
You called me. It was my brother. It was his voice I heard. He's dead. You called me. You called me. Theram? This is more terrible than I thought." He shook his head as a man will do to shake off a nightmare and then put his face in his hands. "Arth, I'm very sorry." "No, call me by name. If you can speak inside my skull with a dead man's voice, then you can call me by my name. Would he have called me Arth? Oh, I see why there's no lying in this mind speech. It is a terrible thing." "All right. All right, speak to me again."
"Wait."
"No, go on."
With his fierce, frightened gaze on me, I bespoke him. "Theram, my friend, there's nothing to fear between us." He kept on staring at me, so I thought he had not understood, but he had.
"Ah, but there is," he said.
After a while, controlling himself, he said calmly,
"You spoke in my language."
"Well, you don't know mine."
"You said there would be words. I know, yet I imagined it as an understanding."
"Empathy is another game, though not unconnected. It gave us the connection tonight. But in mind speech proper, the speech centers of the brain are activated as well as—"
"No, no, no. Tell me that later. Why do you speak in my brother's voice?"
His voice was strained. That I can't answer. I don't know. Tell me about him.
Nuthuth. My full brother, Arek Harthrem Ir-Esrelin. He was a year older than I. He would have been lord of Esther. I left home, you know, for his sake. He's been dead 14 years.
We were both silent for some time. I could not know or ask what lay behind his words. It had cost him too much to say the little he had said. I said at last, "Bespeak me, Thayram. Call me by my name." I knew he could. The rapport was there, or, as the experts have it, the phases were consonant. And of course he had as yet no idea of how to raise the barrier voluntarily. Had I been a listener, I could have heard him think.
"No," he said. "Never. Not yet."
But no amount of shock, awe, terror could restrain that insatiable, outreaching mind for long. After he had cut out the light again, I suddenly heard his stammer in my inward hearing, "Genri." Even mind-speaking, he never could say L properly. I replied at once. In the dark he made an inarticulate sound of fear that had in it a slight edge of satisfaction.
"No more, no more," he said aloud.
After a while we got to sleep at last. It never came easy to him. Not that he lacked the gift or could not develop the skill, but it disturbed him profoundly, and he could not take it for granted. He quickly learned to set up the barriers, but I'm not sure he felt he could count on them. Perhaps all of us were so, when the first educers came back centuries ago from Vakanan's world, teaching the last art to us. Perhaps a Gathenian, being singularly complete, feels telepathic speech as a violation of completeness, a breach of integrity hard for him to tolerate. Perhaps it was Estraven's own character in which candor and reserve were both strong. Every word he said rose out of a deeper silence. He heard my voice bespeaking him as a dead man's, his brother's voice. I did not know what besides love and death lay between him and that brother, but I knew that whenever I bespoke him, something in him winced away as if I touched a wound. So that intimacy of mind established between us was a bond, indeed, but an obscure and austere one, not so much admitting further light, as I had expected it to, as showing the extent of the darkness. And day after day we crept on eastward over the plain of ice. The midpoint in time of our journey as planned, the 35th day, Adorni Anna, found us far short of our halfway point in space. By the sledge meter, we had indeed traveled about 400 miles, but probably only 3/4 of that was real forward gain, and we could estimate only very roughly how far still remained to go. We had spent days, miles, rations in our long struggle to get up onto the ice. Estraven was not so worried as I by the hundreds of miles that still lay ahead of us. "The sledge is lighter," he said. "Towards the end it will be still lighter, and we can cut rations if necessary. We have been eating very well, you know." I thought he was being ironic, but I should have known better. On the 40th day and the 2 succeeding, we were snowed in by a blizzard. During these long hours of lying blotto in the tent, Estevan slept almost continuously and ate nothing, though he drank orsh or sugar water at mealtimes. He insisted that I eat, though only half rations. "You have no experience in starvation," he said. I was humiliated. "How much have you, Lord of a Domain and Prime Minister?"
"Genri, we practice privation until we're experts at it.
I was taught how to starve as a child, at home in Estra and by the Handarata in Rother of Fastness. I got out of practice in Erenrang, true enough, but I began making up for it in Mishnori. Please do as I say, my friend. I know what I'm doing." He did, and I did. We went on for 4 more days of very bitter cold, never above -25 degrees, and then came another blizzard whooping up in our faces from the east on a gale wind. Within 2 minutes of the first strong gust, the snow blew so thick that I could not see Estraven 6 feet away. I had turned my back on him and the sledge, and the plastering, blinding, suffocating snow in order to get my breath, and when a minute later I turned around, he was gone. The sledge was gone. Nothing was there. I took a few steps to where they had been and felt about. I shouted and could not hear my own voice. I was deaf and alone in a universe filled solid with small, stinging gray streaks. I panicked and began to blunder forward, mind-calling frantically, "Theram!" Right under my hand, kneeling, he said, "Come on. Give me a hand with the tent." I did so. I never mentioned my minute of panic. No need to. This blizzard lasted 2 days. There were 5 days lost, and there would be more. Nimmer and Anar are the months of the great storms. "We're beginning to cut it rather fine, aren't we?" I said one night as I measured out our gitchy-mitchy ration and put it to soak in hot water. He looked at me. His firm, broad face showed weight loss in deep shadows under the cheekbones. His eyes were sunken, and his mouth sorely chapped and cracked. God knows what I looked like when he looked like that. He smiled. "With luck we shall make it, and without luck we shall not." It was what he had said from the start. With all my anxieties, my sense of taking a last desperate gamble and so on, I had not been realistic enough to believe him. Even now I thought, surely, when we've worked so hard. But the ice did not know how hard we worked. Why should it? Proportion is kept. "How is your luck running, Theram?" I said at last. He did not smile at that, nor did he answer. Only after a while he said, "I've been thinking about them all down there." Down there for us had come to mean the south, the world below the plateau of ice, the region of earth, men, roads, cities, all of which had become hard to imagine as really existing. "You know that I sent word to the king concerning you the day I left Mishnori. I told him what Shuskis told me, that you were going to be sent to Polevin Farm. At the time I wasn't clear as to my intent, but merely followed my impulse. I have thought the impulse through since. Something like this may happen. The king will see a chance to play Shifgrethor. Tai will advise against it, but Argiven should be growing a little tired of Tai by now, and may ignore his counsel. He will inquire. Where is the envoy, the guest of Karhide? Mishnori will lie. He died of horn fever this autumn, most lamentable. Then how does it happen that we are informed by our own embassy that he's in Pulefin Farm? He's not there, look for yourselves. No, no, of course not. We accept the word of the commensals of Orgorain. But a few weeks after these exchanges, the envoy appears in North Karhide, having escaped from Pulefin Farm. Consternation in Mishnori, indignation in Erenrang, loss of face for the commensals, caught lying. You will be a treasure, a long-lost hearth-brother to King Argiven, Genri. For a while. You must send for your starship at once, at the first chance you get. Bring your people to Karhide, and accomplish your mission at once before Argiven has had time to see the possible enemy in you, before Tybe or some other counselor frightens him once more, playing on his madness. If he makes the bargain with you, he will keep it. To break it would be to break his own Shifgrethor. The Harge kings keep their promises, but you must act fast, and bring the ship down soon." "I will, if I receive the slightest sign of welcome." "No, forgive my advising you, but you must not wait for welcome. You will be welcomed, I think. So will the ship. Karhide has been sorely humbled this past year. You will give Argiven the chance to turn the tables. I think he will take the chance." "Very well, but you, meanwhile—" "I am Estravan the traitor. I have nothing whatever to do with you." "At first." "At first," he agreed. "You'll be able to hide out if there is danger at first?" "Oh, yes, certainly." Our food was ready, and we fell to. Eating was so important and engrossing a business that we never talked any more while we ate. The taboo was now in its complete, perhaps its original form. Not a word said till the last crumb was gone. When it was, he said, "Well, I hope I've guessed well. You do forgive your giving me direct advice?" I said, for there were certain things I had finally come to understand. "Of course I do, Theram. Really, how can you doubt it? You know I have no Chef Grethar to waive. That amused him, but he was still brooding.
Why, he said at last, why did you come alone? Why were you sent alone? Everything still will depend upon that ship coming. Why was it made so difficult for you and for us?
It's the Acumen's custom, and there are reasons for it, though in fact I begin to wonder if I've ever understood the reasons. I thought it was for your sake that I came alone, so obviously alone, so vulnerable that I could in myself post no threat, change no balance, not an invasion but a mere messenger boy. But there's more to it than that. Alone, I cannot change your world, but I can be changed by it. Alone, I must listen as well as speak. Alone, the relationship I finally make, if I make one, is not impersonal and not only political, it is individual. It is personal. It is both more and less than political. Not we and they, not I and it, but I and thou. Not political, not pragmatic, but mystical. In a certain sense, the Ecumen is not a body politic, but a body mystic. It considers beginnings to be extremely important. Beginnings and means. Its doctrine is just the reverse of the doctrine that the end justifies the means. It proceeds, therefore, by subtle ways and slow ones, and queer, risky ones, rather as evolution does, which is, in certain senses, its model. So I was sent alone, for your sake or for my own, I don't know. Yes, it has made things difficult. But I might ask you, as profitably, why you've never seen fit to invent airborne vehicles. One small stolen airplane would have spared you and me a great deal of difficulty. How would it ever occur to a sane man that he could fly? Estevan said sternly. It was a fair response, on a world where no living thing is winged, and the very angels of the Yomesh hierarchy of the Holy do not fly, but only drift, wingless, down to earth like a soft snow falling, like the wind-borne seeds of that flowerless world. Towards the middle of Nimmer, after much wind and bitter cold, we came into a quiet weather for many days. If there were a storm, it was far south of us, down there, and we inside the blizzard had only an all but windless overcast. At first the overcast was thin, so that the air was vaguely radiant with an even sourceless sunlight reflected from both clouds and snow, from above and below. Overnight the weather thickened somewhat. All brightness was gone, leaving nothing. We stepped out of the tent onto nothing. Sledge and tent were there. Estevan stood beside me, but neither he nor I cast any shadow. There was dull light all around, everywhere. When we walked on the crisp snow, no shadow showed the footprint. We left no track. Sledge, tent, himself, myself, nothing else at all. No sun, no sky, no horizon, no world. A whitish-gray void in which we appeared to hang. The illusion was so complete that I had trouble keeping my balance. My inner ears were used to confirmation from my eyes as to how I stood. They got none. I might as well be blind. It was all right while we loaded up, but hauling, with nothing ahead, nothing to look at, nothing for the eye to touch, as it were, it was at first disagreeable and then exhausting. We were on skis, on a good surface of fern without sastrugi, and solid, that was certain, for 5,000 or 6,000 feet down. We should have been making good time. But we kept slowing down, groping our way across the totally unobstructed plain, and it took a strong effort of will to speed up to a normal pace. Every slight variation in the surface came as a jolt, as in climbing stairs, the unexpected stair or the expected but absent stair, for we could not see it ahead. There was no shadow to show it. We skied blind, with our eyes open. Day after day was like this, and we began to shorten our hauls, for by mid-afternoon both of us would be sweating and shaking with strain and fatigue. I came to long for snow, for blizzard, for anything. But morning after morning we came out of the tent into the void, the white weather, but Estevan called the Unshadow. One day about noon, Adorni Nimmer, the 61st day of the journey, that bland, blind nothingness about us, began to flow and writhe. I thought my eyes were fooling me, as they had been doing often, and paid scant attention to the dim, meaningless commotion of the air until suddenly I caught a glimpse of a small, wan, dead sun overhead. And looking down from the sun, straight ahead, I saw a huge black shape come hulking out of the void towards us. Black tentacles writhed upwards, groping out. I stopped dead in my tracks, slewing Estevan around on his skis, for we were both in harness hauling. "What is it?" He stared at the dark, monstrous forms hidden in the fog, and said at last, "The crags. It must be Esherhoth crags," and pulled on. We were miles from the things, which I had taken to be almost within arm's reach. As the white weather turned to a thick, low mist and then cleared off, we saw them plainly before sunset. Nunataks, great scored and ravaged pinnacles of rock jutting up out of the ice, no more of them showing than shows of an iceberg above the sea. Cold, drowned mountains, dead for eons. They showed us to be somewhat north of our shortest course, if we could trust the ill-drawn map that was all we had. The next day we turned, for the first time a little south of east. Chapter 19 Homecoming. In a dark, windy weather we slogged along, trying to find encouragement in the sighting of Esherhoth Crags, the first thing not ice or snow or sky that we had seen for 7 weeks. On the map they were marked as not far from the Shenshe Bogs to the south and from Guthan Bay to the east. But it was not a trustworthy map of the Gobern area, and we were getting very tired. We were nearer the southern edge of the Gobern Glacier than the map indicated, for we began to meet pressure ice and crevasses on the second day of our turn southward. The ice was not so upheaved and tormented as in the Fire Hills region, but it was rotten. There were sunken pits, acres across, probably lakes in summer, false floors of snow that might subside with a huge gasp all around you into the air pocket a foot deep beneath. Areas all slit and pocked with little holes and crevasses, and more often there were big crevasses, old canyons in the ice, some wide as mountain gorges, and others only 2 or 3 feet across, but deep. An Odirni Nimmer, by Estevan's journal, for I kept none, the sun shone clear with a strong north wind. As we ran the sledge across the snow bridges over narrow crevasses, we could look down to left or right into blue shafts and abysses in which bits of ice dislodged by the runners fell with a vast, faint, delicate music, as if silver wires touched thin crystal planes falling. I remember the racy, dreamy, light-headed pleasure of that morning's haul in the sunlight over the abysses. But the sky began to whiten, the air to grow thick, shadows faded, blue drained out of the sky and snow. We were not alert to the danger of white weather on such a surface. As the ice was heavily corrugated, I was pushing while Estevan pulled. I had my eyes on the sledge and was shoving away, mind on nothing but how best to shove, when all at once the bar was nearly wrenched out of my grip as the sledge shot forward in a sudden lunge. I held on by instinct and shouted, "Hey!" to Estevan to slow him down, thinking he had speeded up on a smooth patch. But the sledge stopped dead, tilted nose down, and Estevan was not there. I almost let go the sledge bar to go look for him. It was pure luck that I did not. I held on, while I stared stupidly about for him, and so I saw the lip of the crevasse made visible by the shifting and dropping of another section of the broken snow bridge. He had gone right down feet first, and nothing kept the sledge from following him but my weight, which held the rear third of the runners still on solid ice. It kept tipping a little farther nose downward, pulled by his weight as he hung in harness in the pit. I brought my weight down on the rear bar and pulled and rocked and levered the sledge back away from the edge of the crevasse. It did not come easy, but I threw my weight hard on the bar and tugged until it began grudgingly to move and then slid abruptly right away from the crevasse. Estevan had got his hands onto the edge, and his weight now aided me, Scrambling, dragged by the harness, he came up over the edge and collapsed face down on the ice. I knelt by him trying to unbuckle his harness, alarmed by the way he sprawled there, passive except for the great gasping rise and fall of his chest. His lips were cyanotic. One side of his face was bruised and scraped. He sat up unsteadily and said, in a whistling whisper, "Blue. Oh, Blue. Towers in the depths."
"What?"
"In the crevasse. All blue. Full of light."
"Are you all right?"
He started rebuckling his harness.
"You go ahead. On the rope. With the stick," he gasped. "Pick the route."
For hours one of us hauled, while the other guided, mincing along like a cat on eggshells, sounding every step in advance with the stick. In the white weather one could not see a crevasse until one could look down into it. A little late, for the edges overhung and were not always solid. Every footfall was a surprise, a drop or a jolt, no shadows, an even white, soundless sphere. We moved along inside a huge frosted glass ball. There was nothing inside the ball and nothing was outside it, but there were cracks in the glass. Probe and step, probe and step. Probe for the invisible cracks through which one might fall out of the white glass ball and fall and fall and fall. An unrelaxable tension, little by little, took hold of all my muscles. It became exceedingly difficult to take even one more step.
"What's up, Henry?"
I stood there in the middle of nothing. Tears came out and froze my eyelids together. I said, "I'm afraid of falling."
"But you're on the rope," he said.
Then, coming up and seeing that there was no crevasse anywhere visible, he saw what was up and said,
"Pitch camp."
"It's not time yet. We ought to go on."
He was already unlashing the tent. Later on, after we had eaten, he said,
"It was time to stop.
I don't think we can go this way. The ice seems to drop off slowly and will be rotten and crevassed all the way. If we could see, we could make it, but not in unshadow."
"But then, how do we get down onto the Shenshe Bogs?"
"Well, if we keep east again instead of trending south, we might be on sound ice clear to Guthan Bay. I saw the ice once from a boat on the bay in summer. It comes up against the red hills and feeds down in ice rivers to the bay. If we came down one of those glaciers, we could run due south on the sea ice to Karhide and so enter at the coast rather than the border, which might be better. It will add some miles to our way, though, something between 20 and 50, I should think. What's your opinion, Henry?"
"My opinion is that I can't go 20 more feet so long as the white weather lasts.
But if we get out of the crevassed area—"
"Oh, if we get out of the crevasses, I'll be fine. And if the sun ever comes out again, you get on the sledge, and I'll give you a free ride to Karhide."
That was typical of our attempts at humor. At this stage of the journey, they were always very stupid, but sometimes they made the other fellow smile.
"There's nothing wrong with me," I went on, "except acute chronic fear."
"Fear's very useful. Like darkness, like shadows."
Estevan's smile was an ugly split in a peeling, cracked brown mask thatched with black fur and set with two flecks of black rock. "It's queer that daylight's not enough. We need the shadows in order to walk."
"Give me your notebook a moment."
He had just noted down our day's journey and done some calculation of mileage and rations. He pushed the little tablet and carbon pencil around the Chabe stove to me. On the blank leaf glued to the inner back cover, I drew the double curve within the circle and blacked the yin half of the symbol, then pushed it back to my companion.
"Do you know that sign?"
He looked at it a long time, with a strange look, but he said, "No."
"It's found on Earth, and on Hain Davenant, and on Chifawar. It is yin and yang. Light is the left hand of darkness. How did it go? Light, dark. Fear, courage. Cold, warmth. Female, male. It is yourself, Theram. Both in one. A shadow on snow."
The next day we trudged northeast, through the white absence of everything, until there was no longer any cracks in the floor of nothing, a day's haul.
We were on 2/3 ration, hoping to keep the longer route from running us right out of food. It seemed to me that it would not matter much if it did, as the difference between little and nothing seemed a rather fine one. Estevan, however, was on the track of his luck, following what appeared to be hunch or intuition, but may have been applied experience and reasoning. We went east for 4 days, 4 of the longest hauls we had made, 18 to 20 miles a day, and then the quiet zero weather broke and went to pieces, turning into a whirl, whirl, whirl of tiny snow particles ahead, behind, to the side, in the eyes, a storm beginning as the light died. We lay in the tent for 3 days while the blizzard yelled at us, a 3-day-long, wordless, hateful yell from the unbreathing lungs. "It'll drive me to screaming back," I said to Estevan in mind speech, and he, with the hesitant formality that marked his rapport, "No use. It will not listen." We slept hour after hour, ate a little, tended our frostbites, inflammations and bruises. Mind spoke, slept again. The 3-day shriek died down into a gabbling, then a sobbing, then a silence. Day broke. Through the opened door valve, the sky's brightness shone. It lightened the heart, though we were too run down to be able to show our relief in alacrity or zest of movement. We broke camp. It took nearly 2 hours, for we crept about like 2 old men, and set off. The way was downhill, an unmistakable slight grade. The crust was perfect for skis. The sun shone. The thermometer at mid-morning showed -10 degrees. We seemed to get strength from going, and we went fast and easy. We went that day till the stars came out. For dinner, Estevan served out full rations. At that rate, we had enough for only 7 days more. "The wheel turns," he said with serenity. "To make a good run, we've got to eat." "Eat, drink, and be merry," said I. The food had got me high. I laughed inordinately at my own words. "All one, eating, drinking, merrymaking. Can't have merry without eats, can you?" This seemed to me a mystery quite on a par with that of the yin-yang circle, but it did not last. Something in Estevan's expression dispelled it. Then I felt like crying, but refrained. Estevan was not as strong as I was, and it would not be fair. It might make him cry, too. He was already asleep. He had fallen asleep, sitting up, his bowl on his lap. It was not like him to be so unmethodical. But it was not a bad idea, sleep. We woke rather late next morning, had a double breakfast, and then got in harness and pulled our light sledge right off the edge of the world. Below the world's edge, which was a steep, rubbly slope of white and red in a pallid noonlight, lay the frozen sea, the Bay of Guthan, frozen from shore to shore and from Karhide clear to the North Pole. To get down onto the sea ice through the broken edges and shelves and trenches of the ice jammed up amongst the red hills took that afternoon and the next day. On that second day we abandoned our sledge. We made up backpacks, with the tent as the main bulk of one and the bags of the other, and our food equally distributed. We had less than 25 pounds apiece to carry. I added the Chab stove to my pack and still had under 30. It was good to be released from forever pulling and pushing and hauling and prying that sledge. And I said so to Estevan as he went on. He glanced back at the sledge, a bit of refuse in the vast torment of ice and reddish rock. "It did well," he said. His loyalty extended without disproportion to things, the patient, obstinate, reliable things that we use and get used to, the things we live by. He missed the sledge. That evening, the 75th of our journey, our 51st day in the plateau, Harhahad Anner, we came down off the Gobrin ice onto the sea ice of Guthen Bay. Again we travelled long and late, till dark. The air was very cold, but clear and still, and the clean ice surface, with no sledge to pull, invited our skis.
When we camped that night, it was strange to think, lying down, that under us there was no longer a mile of ice, but a few feet of it, and then salt water. But we did not spend much time thinking. We ate and slept. At dawn, again a clear day, though terribly cold, below minus 40 degrees at daybreak, we could look southward and see the coastline, bulged out here and there with protruding tongues of glacier, fall away southward almost in a straight line. We followed it close inshore at first. A north wind helped us along till we skied up abreast a valley mouth between two high orange hills. Out of that gorge howled a gale that knocked us both off our feet. We scuttled farther east out on the level sea plain, where we could at least stand up and keep going. "The Goeburn ice has spewed us out of its mouth," I said. The next day the eastward curve of the coastline was plain straight ahead of us. To our right was Ogorain, but that blue curve ahead was Carhide. On that day we used up the last grains of Orsh and the last few ounces of Kadik germ. We had left now 2 pounds apiece of Gitchimichi and 6 ounces of sugar. I cannot describe these last days of our journey very well, I find, because I cannot really remember them. Hunger can heighten perception, but not when combined with extreme fatigue. I suppose all my senses were very much deadened. I remember having hunger cramps, but I don't remember suffering from them. I had, if anything, a vague feeling all the time of liberation, of having got beyond something, of joy, also of being terribly sleepy. We reached land on the 12th, Posta Anner, and clambered over a frozen beach and into the rocky, snowy desolation of the Guthan coast. We were in Carhide. We had achieved our goal. It came near being an empty achievement, for our packs were empty. We had a feast of hot water to celebrate our arrival. The next morning we got up and set off to find a road, a settlement. It is a desolate region, and we had no map of it. What roads there might be were under 5 or 10 feet of snow, and we may have crossed several without knowing it. There was no sign of cultivation. We strayed south and west that day and the next, and on the evening of the next, seeing a light shine on a distant hillside through the dusk and thin falling snow, neither of us said anything for some time. We stood and stared. Finally my companion croaked, "Is that a light?" It was long after dark when we came shambling into a Carhidish village, one street between high-roofed dark houses, the snow packed and banked up to their winter doors. We stopped at the hot shop, through the narrow shutters of which flowed, in cracks and rays and arrows, the yellow light we had seen across the hills of winter. We opened the door and went in. It was Odsord ni Anner, the 81st day of our journey. We were 11 days over Estravan's proposed schedule. He had estimated our food supply exactly, 78 days' worth at the outside. We had come 840 miles by the sledge meter, plus a guess for the last few days. Many of those miles had been wasted in backtracking, and if we had really had 800 miles to cover, we should never have made it. When we got a good map, we figured that the distance between Puleffan Farm and this village was less than 730 miles. All those miles and days had been across a houseless, speechless desolation. Rock, ice, sky, and silence, nothing else, for 81 days, except each other. We entered into a big, steaming, hot, bright-lit room full of food and the smells of food, and people, and the voices of people. I caught hold of Estravan's shoulder. Strange faces turned to us, strange eyes. I had forgotten there was anyone alive who did not look like Estravan. I was terrified. In fact, it was rather a small room, and the crowd of strangers in it was 7 or 8 people, all of whom were certainly as taken aback as I was for a while. Nobody comes to Kukura's domain in midwinter from the north at night. They stared and peered, and all the voices had fallen silent. Estravan spoke, a barely audible whisper. "We ask the hospitality of the domain."
Noise, buzz, confusion, alarm. Welcome. We came over the Gobrin ice. More noise, more voices, questions. They crowded in on us. Will you look to my friend? I thought I had said it, but Estravan had. Somebody was making me sit down. They brought us food. They looked after us, took us in, welcomed us home. Benighted, contentious, passionate, ignorant souls, country folk of a poor land, their generosity gave a noble ending to that hard journey. They gave with both hands, no doling out, no counting up, and so Estravan received what they gave us as a lord among lords or a beggar among beggars, a man among his own people. To those fishermen villagers who live on the edge of the edge, on the extreme habitable limit of a barely habitable continent, honesty is as essential as food. They must play fair with one another. There's not enough to cheat with. Estravan knew this, and when after a day or two they got around to asking, discreetly and indirectly, with due regard to Shif Grethor, why we had chosen to spend a winter rambling on the Gobrin ice, he replied at once, "Silence is not what I should choose, yet it suits me better than a lie." "It's well known that honorable men come to be outlawed, yet their shadow does not shrink," said the hot shop cook, who ranked next to the village chief in consequence, and whose shop was a sort of living room for the whole domain in winter. "One person may be outlawed in Karhide, another in Orgarain," said Estravan. "True, and one by his clan, another by the king in Arenrang." "The king shortens no man's shadow, though he may try," Estravan remarked, and the cook looked satisfied. If Estravan's own clan had cast him out, he would be a suspect character, but the king's strictures were unimportant. As for me, evidently a foreigner, and so the one outlawed by Orgarain, that was, if anything, to my credit. We never told our names to our hosts in Korkorost. Estravan was very reluctant to use a false name, and our true ones could not be allowed. It was, after all, a crime to speak to Estravan, let alone to feed and clothe and house him, as they did. Even a remote village of the Guthan coast has radio, and they could not have pleaded ignorance of the order of exile. Only real ignorance of their guest's identity might give them some excuse. Their vulnerability weighed on Estravan's mind before I had even thought of it. On our third night there he came into my room to discuss our next move. A Karhidish village is like an ancient castle of earth in having few or no separate private dwellings. Yet, in the high, rambling old buildings of the hearth, the commerce, the co-domain, there was no lord of Korkorost, and the outer house, each of the 500 villagers could have privacy, even seclusion, in rooms off those ancient corridors with walls 3 feet thick. We had been given a room apiece on the top floor of the hearth. I was sitting in mine beside the fire, a small, hot, heavy-scented fire of peat from the Shenche bogs, when Estravan came in. He said, "We must soon be going on from here, Genri." I remember him standing there in the shadows of the firelit room, barefoot, and wearing nothing but the loose fur breeches the chief had given him. In the privacy and what they considered the warmth of their houses, Karhiders often go half-clothed or naked. On our journey, Estravan had lost all the smooth, compact solidity that marks the Guthenian physique. He was gaunt and scarred, and his face was burned by cold almost as by fire. He was a dark, hard, and yet elusive figure in the quick, restless light. "Where to?"
"South and west, I think. Towards the border. Our first job is to find you a radio transmitter strong enough to reach your ship. After that I must find a hiding place, or else go back into Orgarain for a while to avoid bringing punishment on those who help us here."
"How will you get back into Orgarain?"
"As I did before. Cross the border. The Orgota have nothing against me."
"Where will we find a transmitter?"
"No nearer than Sassenoth."
I winced. He grinned. "Nothing closer?"
150 miles or so. We've come farther over worse ground. There are roads all the way. People will take us in. We may get a lift on a power sledge. I assented, but I was depressed by the prospect of still another stage of our winter journey, and this one not towards Haven, but back to that damned border where Estevan might go back into exile, leaving me alone. I brooded over it and finally said, "There'll be one condition that Garheid must fulfill before it can join the Ecumen. Argivan must revoke your banishment." He said nothing but stood gazing at the fire. "I mean it," I insisted. "First things first."
"I thank you, Genri," he said.
His voice, when he spoke very softly as now, did have much the timbre of a woman's voice, husky and unresonant. He looked at me gently, not smiling.
"But I haven't expected to see my home again for a long time now. I've been in exile for 20 years, you know. This is not so much different, this banishment. I'll look after myself, and you look after yourself and your Ecumen. That you must do alone, but all this is said too soon. Tell your ship to come down. When that's done, then I'll think beyond it."
We stayed 2 more days in Kurkarast, getting well fed and rested, waiting for a road packer that was due in from the south and would give us a lift when they went back again. Our hosts got Estevan to tell them the whole tale of our crossing of the ice. He told it as only a person of an oral literature tradition can tell a story, so that it became a saga full of traditional locutions and even episodes, yet exact and vivid, from the sulphurous fire and dark of the pass between Drumner and Dremagol to the screaming gusts from mountain gaps that swept the Bay of Gufen, with comic interludes, such as his fall into the crevasse, and mystical ones when he spoke of the sounds and silences of the ice, of the shadowless weather, of the night's darkness. I listened as fascinated as all the rest, my gaze on my friend's dark face. We left Kurkarast, riding elbow-jammed in the cab of a road-packer, one of the big powered vehicles that rolls and packs down the snow on Karhadish roads, the main means of keeping roads open in winter, since to try to keep them plowed clear would take half the kingdom's time and money, and all traffic is on runners in the winter anyway. The packer ground along at 2 miles an hour, and brought us into the next village south of Kurkarast long after nightfall. There, as always, we were welcomed, fed, and housed for the night. The next day we went on, afoot. We were now landward of the coastal hills that take the brunt of the north wind off the Bay of Gufen, in a more heavily settled region, and so went not from camp to camp, but from hearth to hearth. A couple of times we did get a lift on a power sledge, once for 30 miles. The roads, despite frequent heavy snowfall, were hard-packed and well-marked. There was always food in our packs, put there by the last night's hosts. There was always a roof and a fire at the end of the day's going. Yet those 8 or 9 days of easy hiking and skiing through a hospitable land were the hardest and dreariest part of all our journey, worse than the ascent of the glacier, worse than the last days of hunger. The saga was over. It belonged to the ice. We were very tired. We were going the wrong direction. There was no more joy in us.
"Sometimes you must go against the wheel's turn," Estevan said.
He was as steady as ever, but in his walk, his voice, his bearing, vigor had been replaced by patience and certainty, by stubborn resolve. He was very silent, nor would he mind speak with me much. We came to Sassanoth, a town of several thousand, perched up on hills above the frozen eye, roofs white, walls gray, hills spotted black with forest and rock outcropping, fields and river white, across the river the disputed Sinoth Valley, all white. We came there all but empty-handed. Most of what remained of our travel equipment we had given away to various kindly hosts, and by now we had nothing but the chabe stove, our skis, and the clothes we wore. Thus unburdened, we made our way, asking directions a couple of times, not into the town, but to an outlying farm. It was a meager place, not part of a domain, but
a single farm under the Sinoth Valley administration. When Estraven was a young secretary in that administration, he had been a friend of the owner, and in fact had bought this farm for him a year or two ago when he was helping people resettle east of the A, in hopes of obviating dispute over the ownership of the Sinoth Valley. The farmer himself opened his door to us, a stocky, soft-spoken man of about Estraven's age. His name was Thesiger. Estraven had come through this region with hood pulled up and forward to hide his face. He feared recognition here. He hardly needed to. It took a keen eye to see Harth Ramir Estraven in a thin, weather-worn tramp. Thesiger kept staring at him covertly, unable to believe that he was who he said he was. Thesiger took us in, and his hospitality was up to standard, though his means were small. But he was uncomfortable with us. He would rather not have had us. It was understandable. He risked the confiscation of his property by sheltering us. Since he owed that property to Estraven, and might by now have been as destitute as we if Estraven had not provided for him, it seemed not unjust to ask him to run some risk in return. My friend, however, asked his help not in repayment, but as a matter of friendship, counting not on Thesiger's obligation, but on his affection. And indeed, Thesiger thawed after his first alarm was past, and with Karhidish volatility became demonstrative and nostalgic, recalling old days and old acquaintances with Estraven beside the fire half the night. When Estraven asked him if he had any idea as to a hiding place, some deserted or isolated farm where a banished man might lie low for a month or two in hopes of a revocation of his exile, Thesiger at once said, "Stay with me." Estraven's eyes lit up at that, but he demurred, and, agreeing that he might not be safe so near Sassenoth, Thesiger promised to find him a hideout. It wouldn't be hard, he said, if Estraven would take a false name and hire out as a cook or farmhand, which would not be pleasant, perhaps, but certainly better than returning to Orgorain. "What the devil would you do in Orgorain? What would you live on, eh?" "On the commensality," said my friend, with a trace of his otter's smile. "They provide all units with jobs, you know. No trouble. But I'd rather be in Karhide, if you really think it could be managed." We had kept the Cheb stove, the only thing of value left to us. It served us, one way or another, right to the end of our journey. The morning after our arrival at Thesiger's farm, I took the stove and skied into town. Estraven, of course, did not come with me, but he had explained to me what to do, and it all went well. I sold the stove at the town commerce, then took the solid sum of money it had fetched up the hill to the little college of the trades where the radio station was housed, and bought 10 minutes of private transmission to private reception. All stations set aside a daily period of time for such shortwave transmissions, as most of them are sent by merchants to their overseas agents or customers in the archipelago, Sith or Perunter. The cost is rather high, but not unreasonable. Less, anyway, than the cost of a second-hand Cheb stove. My 10 minutes were to be early in third hour late afternoon. I did not want to be skiing back and forth from Thesiger's farm all day long, so I hung around Sassenoth and bought a large, good, cheap lunch in one of the hot shops. No doubt that Karhide's cooking was better than Orgota. As I ate, I remembered Estraven's comment on that when I had asked him if he hated Orgorain. I remembered his voice last night saying with all mildness, "I'd rather be in Karhide." And I wondered, not for the first time, what patriotism is, what the love of country truly consists of, how that yearning loyalty that had shaken my friend's voice arises, and how so real a love can become too often so foolish and vile a bigotry. Where does it go wrong? After lunch, I wandered about Sassenoth. The business of the town, the shops and markets and streets, lively despite snow flurries and zero temperature, seemed like a play, unreal, bewildering. I had not yet come altogether out of the solitude of the ice. I was uneasy among strangers and constantly missed Estraven's presence beside me. I climbed the steep snow-packed street in dusk to the college and was admitted and shown how to operate the public-use transmitter. At the time appointed,
I sent the wake signal to the relay satellite, which was in stationary orbit about 300 miles over South Karhide. It was there as insurance for just a situation as this, when my Ansible was gone so that I could not ask Aulol to signal the ship, and I had not time or equipment to make direct contact with the ship in solar orbit. The Sasanov transmitter was more than adequate, but as the satellite was not equipped to respond except by sending to the ship, there was nothing to do but signal it and let it go at that. I could not know if the message had been received and relayed to the ship. I did not know if I had done right to send it. I had come to accept such uncertainties with a quiet heart. It had come on to snow hard, and I had to spend the night in town, not knowing the roads well enough to want to set off on them in the snow and dark. Having a bit of money still, I inquired for an inn, at which they insisted that I put up at the college. I had dinner with a lot of cheerful students, and slept in one of the dormitories. I fell asleep with a pleasant sense of security, and assurance of Karhide's extraordinary and unfailing kindness to the stranger. I had landed in the right country in the first place, and now I was back. So I fell asleep. But I woke up very early and set off for Thesiger's farm before breakfast, having spent an uneasy night full of dreams and wakenings. The rising sun, small and cold in a bright sky, sent shadows westward from every break and hummock in the snow. The road lay all streaked with dark and bright. No one moved in all the snowy fields, but away off on the road a small figure came towards me with the flying, gliding gait of the skier. Long before I could see the face, I knew it for Estravin. "What's up, Theram?"
"I've got to get to the border," he said, not even stopping as we met. He was already out of breath. I turned, and we both went west, I hard put to keep up with him. With the road turned to enter Sasanov, he left it, skiing out across the unfenced fields. We crossed the frozen eye a mile or so north of town. The banks were steep, and at the end of the climb we both had to stop and rest. We were not in condition for this kind of race. "What happened?"
"Thesiger?"
"Yes. Heard him on his wireless set at daybreak." Estravan's chest rose and fell in gasps, as it had when he lay on the ice beside the blue crevasse. "Tide must have a price on my head."
"The damned ungrateful traitor,"
I said, stammering, not meaning Tide, but Thesiger, whose betrayal was of a friend.
"He is that," said Estravan. "But I asked too much of him, strained a small spirit too far. Listen, Genry, go back to Sasanov.
I'll at least see you over the border, Theram. There may be Orgota guards there.
I'll stay on this side, for God's sake."
He smiled. Still breathing very hard, he got up and went on, and I went with him. We skied through small, frosty woods and over the hillocks and fields of the disputed valley. There was no hiding, no skulking. A sunlit sky, a white world, and we two strokes of shadow on it, fleeing. Uneven ground hid the border from us till we were less than an eighth of a mile from it. Then we suddenly saw it plain, marked with a fence. Only a couple of feet of the poles showing above the snow, the pole tops painted red. There were no guards to be seen on the Orgota side. On the near side there were ski tracks, and southward several small figures moving. "There are guards on this side. You'll have to wait till dark, Theram."
"Tibes inspectors,"
he gasped bitterly, and swung aside. We shot back over the little rise we had just topped and took the nearest cover. There we spent the whole long day, in a dell among the thick-growing hemin trees, their reddish boughs bent low around us by loads of snow. We debated many plans of moving north or south along the border to get out of this particularly troubled zone, of trying to get up into the hills east of Sasanov, even of going back up north into the empty country, but each plan had to be vetoed. Estravan's presence had been betrayed, and we could not travel in Karhide openly as we had been doing. Nor could we travel secretly for any distance at all. We had no tent, no food, and not much strength. There was nothing for it but the straight dash over the border. No way was open but one. We huddled in the dark hollow under dark trees in the snow. We lay right together for warmth. Around midday,
Estravan dozed off for a while, but I was too hungry and too cold for sleep. I lay there beside my friend, in a sort of stupor, trying to remember the words he had quoted to me once.